welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's golden years. Mark Livonier, your host for this hour of variety, with a fascinating program, The Magic Key. Among the voices you'll hear is legendary commentator, announcer, and reporter Graham McNamee. Just a month before this broadcast, he was heard as announcer on the Rudy Valley Show, where Helen Keller appeared. Mirth, melody, and on-the-scene airplane reporting, which was most likely very compelling listening to the Magic Key audience when this episode was first broadcast on the NBC Blue Network on March 22, 1936.
The Radio Corporation of America presents The Magic Key. Radio service of the Radio Corporation of America, the Magic Key of RCA turns to Dresden, Germany, Newark, New Jersey, Chicago, Illinois, and New York City to bring you an hour of entertainment featuring the pleasing tenor of Lanny Ross, the rapid-fire news comment of Floyd Gibbons, Ernest Sack, sensational European caratura soprano, Ray Noble and his famous Victor Recording Orchestra, a special aviation feature with Graham McNamee, and Frank Black and the NBC Symphony opening the program with a colorful Hungarian scene and dance from the ballet Raimondo by Glazunov.
Many millions of Americans live far from the Mississippi and its tributaries. Yet one famous Mississippi River vessel visits them via radio every week, the Maxwell House Showboat. Today, the young star of Showboat, Lanny Ross, is here in the studio to entertain us. Graduate of Yale and the Yale Glee Club, known for his work in motion pictures and concert as well as over the air, Lanny Ross perfectly fulfills, in person and personality, the promise of his voice. He is the romantic young tenor par excellence. For his first selection today, he has chosen to depart from his usual repertoire, singing the famous operatic aria, Le Rêve, from Massenet's masterpiece, Manon. The magic key of RCA turns to Lanny Ross. For an encore, Lanny Ross sings one of the melodies he helped to make popular, Dream Lover.
There's There's a land of charm that I know, land of sweet romance where I long to go. And its bounds touch my room in the gloom when the shadows fall. Someone I meet there waits for me, someone tender as a lover should be. And I whisper each night as I close my eyes for sleep. Dream, lover, fold your arms around me. Dream, lover, I'm so glad you found.
Nearly all the fine radio programs with which Lanny Ross has been associated have been released over networks of the National Broadcasting Company. Together with the NBC, these other members of the family of RCA, RCA Communications, Radio Marine, RCA Victor, RCA Radiotron, and the RCA Institutes take pleasure in presenting these Sunday programs for the interest and entertainment of families everywhere.
During 1935, airlines operated by American companies carried 860,761 passengers, an increase of about 50% over the best previous year. Definitely, travel-minded America is looking skyward. Doubtless, one reason for this is the increased safety with which airplanes today are operated, and in this, radio has played a stellar part. How? Well, let's visit the huge aerial port of call that serves New York City and see just how the big liners of the air are handled. The magic key of RCA turns to the Newark Airport.
Okay, left and right motors checked out. Take it to the hangar.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. This is Graham McNamee speaking to you from the heart of the vast air terminal for the metropolitan area at Newark, New Jersey. Right now, I'm standing by the door of the Eastern Airlines hangar, where a giant plane is being loaded, not with the usual passengers and mail, but with blankets, food, antitoxins, and serum from one of the flood-stricken areas of the East. A note of feverish emergency underlies the orderly activity of this airport this afternoon, for in addition to unprecedented travel due to flood conditions, the airlines have brought every available plane from other sections of the country to Newark for the American Red Cross and other relief agencies to ship bedding, food, and medicinal supplies to the devastated areas. And what a picture it is, with crates, burlap bundles, and army cots piled along the runways that ordinarily see the trim baggage of transcontinental passengers. And now they're jockeying the big plane into position. She's ready to take off on her errand of mercy. She's ready to go now. And she's off. And incidentally, let me tell you now, that's the last word that we get here, is that floodwaters are receding in Pennsylvania and in New England. And there she goes. And now, there's another ship yonder on the ramp, wheeling into position to take on a load of gasoline.
What's the payload on 1537, Bill?
2,257.
Let's see, she'll want 140 gallons more.
Yep, they're going out now to pour the lifeblood into this airliner of the great silver fleet. What about the shops here behind us? Let's go inside. Here it is that the inspectors go over these Douglas, Boeing, Curtis Wright Condors, and Stinson, with a fine-tooth comb, testing every mechanical part and every control every trip, from the leather cushion seats in the cabin to the rudder and the spark plugs, and that vital heart of every ship, the radio. You see, the idea behind it all is to make the air lanes of America as safe as a cow path back on the farm. And here's another big ship right out in front of us. Two men, a crew chief and an inspector, are just climbing down from the cockpit. One of them is carrying a long, legal-looking piece of paper. The other is calling off items.
$100 check on right engine number 22742.
Right.
Check oil tank full of cap nut.
Check.
Remove number 20 carburetor air scoop. Install 22.
Check.
Radio batteries are low. Recharge them.
Check.
Inspect radio power. Inspect radio power. Inspect radio power. Inspect radio power.
Check.
Test transmitter.
Check.
Straighten prop control. Handle support in the pilot's cockpit.
Well, complicated? It may sound like a garage mechanic's nightmare, but believe me, in the air it spells safety for the passengers of American aviation. There's a plane warming up on the ramp. Suppose we go through the waiting room and on to the gate and watch her take off. TWA and American Airlines and Eastern passengers check their tickets and their baggage before they climb aboard for the takeoff. Yep, here's the door. We'll go in. A complete waiting room, even to the plane caller.
Call for Eastern Airline number 33 for Miami. Waiting is 10 minutes. All aboard American Airline Curtis Wright Condor Sleeper for Fort Worth, El Paso, and Los Angeles. Last call, ship leaving at gate number 5.
And that's where we want to go, gate number 5, to see a great transcontinental liner take off. While I'm on the way out there, I'm going to transfer you to the radio room, in which you can hear the pulse of traffic all along the eastern seaboard. The operators are in constant two-way touch with the ships in the air, and with the radio control tower, where a traffic cop regulates all traffic in and out of the airport, giving ships clearance to leave the ground, advising them when and where to drop from the sky. These ships may be 100 miles away, but their radios make them always close to home. But I've got to race now for gate 5, or we'll miss that plane. Meanwhile, listen to the flow of air traffic as it registers from the loudspeaker in the radio room.
Go ahead, control tower.
WRAE to American Airlines number 30. The wind is northwest, it's variable to the west. 30 mile an hour and gusty to 50 at times. The Colesman altimeter is 2970. It's all clear to take off.
This is Graham McNamee at gate number 5. The great Curtis Wright Condor of the American Airlines is here in front of us, all set to go. You can hear her warming up, I'm sure, now. Now she's moving, turning slightly to get a dead reckoning on her long journey. And she's off, racing down the field, gathering speed, as graceful as the mighty condor after which she is named. She's in the air, that great clipper of the skies, roaring westward.
Now we speak to you from the glass enclosed control tower atop the administration building of Chicago's municipal airport, the busiest airport in the world. This is the nerve center of a swiftly changing scene of aerial activity. Around us are numerous complex instruments measuring wind velocity and direction, controlling signal lights and landing floodlights, radio receivers tuned to wavelengths of the different airlines, their loudspeakers growling out messages from pilots flying east, west, north, and south, ever in contact with the home field through the magic medium of radio. Chief Operator John Becker, in charge of this system that regulates arrivals and departures from Chicago Municipal, sits before a desk covered with controlling mechanisms, with a microphone at his elbow. From time to time, pilots report their positions, and he checks them on a chart, noting their altitude and exact distance from the port. Not only this, but the planes in the immediate vicinity of the field are taking off and landing according to his directions via radio. Chief Becker advising them of the ground wind, its speed and direction, the proper runway, and advice as to other ships in the air about the port. Just a few minutes ago, another great airliner reported in to Chief Becker, stating his position as over Aurora, Illinois, some 30 miles west of the port, at an altitude of 3,000 feet descending. Checking that position and elapsed time, Chief Becker notes that it's now time to call him again and give him the proper landing information. He reaches for the microphone, presses a button.
WGEH to Jack Knight in United Airlines 347. You must be over Downers Grove by now. Go ahead, Jack.
Knight, United 347, over Hinsdale at 3,000, descending. Landing instructions, please.
Okay, Jack. The wind is east, about 10 miles. Land east. There was a Northwest Airlines Electra over Maywood a half a minute ago at 2,500. And a Chicago and Southern Stinson must be in your vicinity. He reported over Joliet about 6 minutes ago. Can you see him? Go ahead, Jack.
Yes, I sighted him about 3 miles to the south. I expect to come in about 2 minutes.
Okay, Jack. You are the closest ship, and you can prepare to come in directly. Go ahead, Jack.
Okay, John. Thanks.
Okay, Jack. I'll be watching for you.
And now, let's swing skyward by radio and hear from that faraway ship. Out of sight, yes, but never out of touch of radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Charles Lyon speaking from a comfortable seat in one of the speedy, soundproof Boeing transports of United Airlines, flying eastward toward Chicago Airport under the skillful hands of Jack Knight, one of the most outstanding transport pilots in the world, with nearly 2 million miles of flying to his credit. Over this same route 15 years ago, Knight flew the first night air mail from Omaha to Chicago. No lighted airways then, no radio beacons with their guiding tone beat to keep the flyer on his course. No comfortable cabin with its bank of scientific instruments. Then it was an open cockpit, whipped by wind and snow with a clumsy ship and motor, and below an occasional bonfire to keep him on his course. But today, how different. We eat and read while the ground unfolds below the outstretched wings, completely relaxed, always in touch with the home port by radio. And now the home port is in view to the eastward. The city looms up through the haze. Slowly we begin to drop earthward. The checkerboard of fields and streets spreads out in greater contrast. Houses and other objects assume their proper perspective. Now, the whir as co-pilot George Cassidy releases the mechanism that lowers the retractable landing gear. A light flashes on against the forward wall of the cabin stating, "No smoking. Fasten your seatbelt." Smiling stewardess Ruth Kimmel moves along the aisle, checking to see that we have done so. It's time to reach for the hat and coat, hold the magazine, and watch the skill of the pilot as we settle like a feather on the long, hard surface runway that stretches ahead to welcome us. Our trip is almost over.
And back in the control tower, we watch the sleek gray ship. It's slanting smoothly earthward, 7 tons of streamlined perfection, slipping in over the housetops like a gray ghost against the lighter gray of the March sky, dropping lower and lower. Now it's straightening out, smoothly touching landing gear. A light touch on the brakes checks that forward roll. Now the pilot guns the motors. The ship wheels easily forward on its fat tires toward the canopy of the passenger terminal and the waiting red caps. Radio has again guided another plane safely home, and having done so, the magic key of RCA turns eastward to New York.
When you seat yourself in a giant air transport, you are in a plane made safer because RCA has pioneered in the development of radio beams which guide the ship unerringly from city to city, day or night, and in the development of two-way radio communication, making possible a constant interchange of information between the pilot in the air and the trained weather observers on the ground. In addition to this pioneering service, practically every airplane carries some equipment built by RCA. Wherever you may go, on land or sea or in the air, the universal radio service of the Radio Corporation of America is constantly at your disposal. In the best-equipped motion picture theaters, you will find RCA Photophone. In thousands of homes where the best in radio reception is taken for granted, you will find RCA Victor Magic Brain radios with the magic eye and RCA metal tubes. On the ships at sea, in offices, in ways without number, the Radio Corporation of America serves you, the American public, offering every facility in the field of radio for business, pleasure, and the safeguarding of life. RCA Communications, RCA Radiotron, Radio Marine, RCA Photophone, RCA Victor, the RCA Institute, you know them all by name. And you know that together they constitute the family of RCA, the most important factor in American radio, and the only organization in the world equipped to give universal radio service.
Dance music with an Oxford accent, and it's taking America by storm. Ray Noble, talented young English stylist with his smart arrangements and ingratiating rhythms, demonstrates to modern dance fans that music is an international art. Already popular in this country before he came here, by reason of his many fine Victor records, Ray Noble, in a comparatively short time, has won recognition as one of the outstanding orchestra leaders in the United States. Appearing by courtesy of the Coca-Cola Company, Mr. Noble has chosen for his first selection this afternoon a most recent hit by the Dean of American Popular Composers, Irving Berlin. The Magic Key of RCA turns to Ray Noble and his orchestra playing Let Yourself Go from Follow the Fleet. Continuing our program, Frank Black, director of music for the National Broadcasting Company, conducts the NBC Symphony Orchestra in the stirring Marche Écossaise by Claude Debussy.
The current concert season abroad was marked by an individual triumph as notable as that of Marian Anderson here in the United States. The European artist who created a furore in the music-loving capitals of the continent is gifted with a voice as high and silvery as Miss Anderson's is deep and mellow. Indeed, the European critics unanimously hail the voice of Erna Sack as not only the highest, but one of the truest soprano voices in the world. At this moment in the city of Dresden, 3,100 miles away, this beautiful and talented young singer is waiting to entertain us. The magic key of RCA turns to Erna Sack singing from Dresden.
Hello, America. Hello, America. I'm pleased to sing for the RCA program of the National Broadcasting Company. Johann Strauss, Voice of Spring Tune, which is most popular with my European listeners.
Oh! Hello, America. Hello, America. The magic key of RCA transmitting you across the Atlantic to New York City.
Back in America for an authoritative evaluation of the front page news of the day. Spring floods striking with unparalleled fury in widely separated sections are filling newspapers from coast to coast with columns of black type. What's the latest news from the stricken areas? How are survivors being cared for? A shocked and anxious public eagerly seeks to learn the facts. In our studio today, we have one of the world's greatest fact finders, fact reporters, the celebrated headline hunter, Floyd Gibbons. An ace correspondent in the Richard Harding Davis tradition, Mr. Gibbons has been reporting excitement through a newspaper career of 30 years. Now, just returned from a hazardous plane trip over the Connecticut Valley, he's ready to bring us a characteristically vivid eyewitness report of just what's what. The magic key of RCA turns to Floyd Gibbons.
Thanks, Ben Grauer, and hello, everybody. This is my first appearance before a microphone in America in almost 7 months, and it's mighty glad I am to be here. My last appearance was way back last August on the day before I sailed from New York bound for the war front in Africa. I was mighty happy when the Magic Key invited me to tell a few yarns about the turbulent state of affairs I left in Europe and Africa a month ago, and I was all prepared to talk about that, but, well, just a few minutes ago, you see, that idea was suddenly discarded, and I've been asked to say something about another turbulent condition going on right here at home in a darn sight closer to the hearts of America. So it's a sad story I bring you from New England today. The people of one of the happiest, richest, most fertile, most industrious valleys in the world lie helpless before the surging advance of a destructive force completely beyond their power to combat, control, or escape. The Connecticut River is running wild. Millions of American factory workers and farmers last night faced another night of thunder, lightning, and rain, of rising waters and straining dams and creaking bridges. It was cold and wet and, for the most part, dark and cheerless last night in the once happy valley, while storm signals flying up and down the Atlantic coast brought dread warning of further destruction and devastation on the crest of the worst flood in the history of the last half century. Though through rain squalls and lowering black clouds late yesterday afternoon, I flew back to New York after an exciting 300-mile flight up and down both sides of the Connecticut Valley, which in some places has taken on the appearance of a vast inland sea. On the outer reaches of the spreading flood, the red brick chimneys and shingled rooftops of New England homes barely show above the surface of the rising water. Flying 50 feet above them, I saw bedraggled wet chickens perched bewildered upon these isolated elevations like animated weathercocks. And closer toward the center of the valley, the expanse of water is striped with drunken rows of huge round-topped cylinders, gleaming silver against the muddy water like beds of withered mushrooms. They are the gas and oil tanks of refining companies, each silver mushroom representing hundreds of thousands of gallons of explosive fuel, which in turn represents fire and disaster should these enormous receptacles be torn loose from their foundations and swept or rolled downstream to crash against the projecting tops of inundated villages or wooden homes and loose their fiery contents. I saw many of the half-submerged tanks being lashed to one another with steel cables attached by frantically working crews of boatmen who looked like Lilliputians trying to tie down these deadly metallic giants with spans of thread. And in the riverbed, the bedstream of the river itself, the normal water course in which ambitious man had hoped to incarcerate Old Man River with dikes and dams of stone and steel, the prisoner is lashing, foaming, writhing like a serpent, striking back with frightful force and power and unexpected fury. The torrent is mad there in the confines of its mad-made cell. It leaps in spray and waves and billows of foam and floating wreckage that seem, well, they seem like the tensing and flexing of giant muscles as they tear and dig away at the foundations of factory walls and bridge abutments, as they rip off the ends of barns or grab whole wooden houses from their foundations and tumble them away into the flood downstream like boxes and crates. Like a slave freed from the chains of his presumptuous would-be masters, the river is striking back in wild retaliation. It seems to say, for years I have turned your wheels and lighted your cities and watered your fields and cattle and heated your homes and transported your commerce. And now comes my day of revolt to show you my strength. And the power and the lighting plants are dark and deserted in Hartford and other cities, while torrents 10 feet deep course through the main streets and people saw their way around by candlelight last night. I saw railroad bridges weighted down with double lines of loaded coal cars in the final attempt to save the structures from the grip of the angry waters. We flew over inundated roads far back from the stream bed. They were dotted with the black tops of abandoned cars, looking for all the world like glistening backs of drowned beetles. Riverside factories are deserted, with smokeless chimneys rearing themselves high above the flood, which digs and tugs at their underpinning, while thousands of workers have been forced to down tools and beat hasty retreats to places of safety. Many deserted farms on highland are now islands on which we saw dismal, unmilked cows wandering around, apparently wondering where the family had gone. And by the way, this piece of this bulletin has just been handed to me. E.G. Stewart, chairman of the Hartford Disaster Committee, reports the situation well in hand in Hartford. The public is requested to refrain from wiring or phoning to the Red Cross regarding the safety of relatives. All refugees are in safe quarters and in comfortable condition. From my observations, the worst part of the flood extends south down the Connecticut Valley from Holyoke, Massachusetts, to Middletown, Connecticut. Bill Cleveland, the veteran Navy flyer who is the pilot of the Universal Service amphibian plane, flew me on this flight accompanied by his mechanic, Louis. Now, you see, Bill is not only a pilot, but an aerial photographer. I like him better in either capacity, one at a time, but I'm not so strong for him. When he leans out of the pilot window with a big air camera in his left arm, while he pilots with his right hand, a one-hand driver, you see, on the wheel, and he sideslips down to 100 feet above the rooftops to get the exact position for a camera shot. Then, Louis takes over the wheel and holds the plane steady on its downward sideslip until Bill's camera clicks, and he shouts, "Hit her, boy!" Well, Louis got us out of those forests of tall factory chimneys successfully with many a narrow squeak, but I did think that we were going to do a Santa Claus down the smokestack of the state penitentiary at Wethersfield, Connecticut, when Bill put that plane into a vicious sideslip so that he could get a picture of convicts and trustees pumping water out of their recreation grounds down below. You know, I sort of envied those convicts in safety down there in that pen. You know, I'm glad my yarn for today was changed from Ethiopia to New England because, you see, it gives me an opportunity to express my admiration and pay my respects to a newly developed class of men and women whose ardent enthusiasm for their hobby and whose high regard for duty have been instrumental in saving thousands of lives and preventing unlimited suffering in the national flood disaster. I refer to the work of the short and long wave amateur operators, the boys and girls that some of the professional radio bugs used to refer to as radio hams. Well, sir, never again will they be called that. They have earned their spurs to new and high distinction in the last week. When landlines and other means of high-power communication became disrupted before the rush of the waters, these radio amateurs stuck to their dangerous posts and carried on. They maintained communications. They kept going a running fire of information, advice, description of conditions, instructions for the distribution of relief, directions for traffic and weather reports. To them, for their courage and unselfish devotion to duty, goes the praise and the thanks of the nation, to which I modestly add this wholehearted measure of my own sincere admiration. Radio amateurs of America, you're the tops. You changed the subject of my yarn from Africa to America, and I thank you. Ethiopia will have to wait for the next time, and I'm signing over to Milton Cross.
RCA Victor dealers throughout the country have been literally swamped with business these last few weeks. I'm going to ask Mr. Howard Cervantes, president of Haynes Griffin Company, located in the fashionable Madison Avenue shopping district of New York City, who's present in this studio today, to explain the sudden great increase in business.
That's easy. Hundreds of thousands of people have been wanting for a long time to have a real RCA Victor radio with magic brain, magic eye, RCA metal tubes, and everything. But they just haven't been able to see their way clear to buying one.
Well, and have they all suddenly inherited money?
The reason they're buying now is because we have two new models. Both full-size radio consoles incorporating RCA Victor's exclusive features, the Magic Brain, Magic Eye, RCA metal tubes, and a 12-inch dynamic speaker at a price almost $30 less than you previously had to pay for such an instrument. Only $89.95 here in New York. People have the money to spend, and when they can make such a saving, naturally they're going to buy.
Well, thanks, Mr. Cervantes, and may business continue to increase. It should, with such a value to offer. Think of it. An RCA Victor radio with Magic Brain, Magic Eye, and RCA metal tubes for nearly $30 less than ever before. Why not visit your RCA Victor dealer tomorrow? Ask him to demonstrate either model C819 or C820. Easy payments can be arranged.
Thank you.
we cordially invite you to be with us next Sunday when the magic key will turn again and members of the family of RCA will present Ephraim Zimbalist, the famed violinist, and Frank Black conducting the NBC Symphony.
The Magic Key, on Tuned to Yesterday, an NBC Blue Network broadcast from the 22nd of March, 1936. And that brings the curtain down on this hour of variety on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.